I'm Hugo Disler from Farming Secrets. We've got online David Davidson from Broomfield. Now, David, are you there?
Yes, I am, Hugo.
Now, David, can you, we'll just get going straight away. Can you give us a bit of a rundown of your history in the worm farming? We are going to talk about vermicompost, so can you just lead the way right from the beginning?
Okay, Hugo. For people who don't know, we're situated in central Victoria, about half an hour out of Ballarat, in a reasonably reliable rainfall area, around about 28 inches in the old terms per year, but we do have our dries and we do have our droughts. And my farm's 100 acres of undulating country, medium quality. It's certainly not top quality for Ballarat District, and it's sort of verging on the gravelly gold mining country, but it was used as a dairy farm before we took over 25 years ago. The interesting thing is that when we took over the farm, my plans at that stage was to set it up as a harness racing stable and to breed horses and race horses, and to have a few cows to sort of use the pasture that we didn't need for the horses. So, and at that stage, I guess my goal was that if we could develop the farm to its capacity, then the next step would be to buy more acreage. So where we're at now, ironically, is that we've already doubled the capacity of our farm by just using worm casting and worm tea in conjunction with holistic grazing management, and also understanding carbon grazing, as explained by Alan Lauder. His website, I think, is a really good one for anyone to have a look at. And of course, listening to the multitude of people in the Farming Secrets family. So I have to say that people like Hugh Lovell, Hamish Mackay, the biodynamic people, and there's been Tony Evans, Malcolm Beck, Elaningham, Graham Ham, Peter Andrews, Joel Salverson, just the list goes on and on. So it's been a journey where we just picked up a little bit, or sometimes a lot, from listening to other people talk and basically modified it to suit our own needs here. So an interesting thing is that right now I've retired from paid work but probably earning more money through the worms than I have ever before. But given that we're now taking food waste from the canes and vermicomposting that, the amount of land that we need to do that is about 2 acres. So the other 98 is really nice to walk over and enjoy looking at the horses and the cows, but it just shows how you start off in one direction, but you can finish up in a totally different direction. And it's a matter of sort of continually adjusting and looking for new opportunities. And I think that's probably the biggest challenge for farmers today, with the cost of things and the reliance on chemical fertilisers, is to be able to think outside the box and say, okay, if I'm not doing well enough this way, what else can I do with the facilities that I've already got? Go on, Hugo.
No, keep going. We want to get on to your history as to how you started and where you're at now with the worms, although you've sort of come in from the where you are now with what you're doing at the very moment. So can you give us a bit of a rundown of how you started in the worm industry, and from what size you were then to what size you are now in terms of vermicomposting?
So it's probably between 15 and 20 years ago now, I guess. I was at the stage where I was happily training horses and trying to hopefully build up to the stage where I could be a professional horse trainer. And we had quite a lot of stable manure accumulating, and I saw an ad in the paper for people selling compost worms and selling a marketing system whereby they would guarantee to buy back the worms as they multiplied, and I looked into that, and fortunately realised it dodgy, but in doing my own due diligence, I became fascinated by the potential for worms in agriculture. So whilst I didn't get into the marketing side of it, we did purchase a few thousand worms and started converting the stable manure into vermicarb. Studied that for quite a long while. Went through a period where we went to the farmers market selling the worm castings and the worm. And then I guess through that, a friend of mine who had was also a worm grower and had the contract for taking food waste from the local hospitals in Ballarat rang me up and said that he wanted to retire and would I be interested in taking over his run, which I did, so which meant that I then started taking about 2.5 tonne of food waste per week and using the word composting it and vermicomposting it to, once again, basically to make fertiliser for my own farm. And then about 8 months after that, I got a phone call from someone at McCain's Food who became aware that I was taking the food waste from the hospital and would I come and have a talk to them about seeing if we could do something with the food waste from the factory. So as a result of that, we got the kind of, we're now taking up to 20 tonne and I believe potentially even double that a week. So we've gone from having a little backyard worm farm to now having a full-scale commercial operation. But we're still doing it on a shoestring. I've got a little 35-horsepower Chinese tractor with a front-end loader that keeps breaking down every third week. And, with a lot of these things, when I listen to Peter Andrews and what he's done on his farm, I'm just amazed at that, that we've never been in a situation where we could sort of bring in bulldozers and make big weirs and stuff like that. So we've always done things on a shoestring. But we've adapted the ideas that we've learned from other composters and so far I believe we've got a system that's quite simple but it's effective and gets the job done. So go on then. Here we go.
David, we'll get on to how your worm farming can affect farming. What's in it for the farmer? How can a farmer start? Can any farmer do it? And sort of let's look at it from the farming side to get more farmers to use vermicompost or to use this process.
Yes, and I guess from my understanding is that the key is organic matter in the soil, the amount of organic matter that you can get into your soil. And I think it was the ANZ Bank during the drought, commissioned some people to do a survey to try and establish which farmers were the best risk or the least risk when they were lending money to them. And the result of that survey came back that the more organic matter a particular farmer had in the soil on his property, the more likely he was to be successful. And I guess we know from history that Australia overall had an average of 4 or 5% organic matter when it was first discovered in the soil, and the average today is below 1%. So, year after year of tilling and then applying chemicals and clearing and allowing erosion has sort of taken its toll, and we now have a lot of farmers on marginal ground with very little organic matter in the soil. So for me, my advice is everything we do should be looking at how we get that organic matter and the carbon back into the soil. And the two alternatives there is the one is to buy it in, which is incredibly expensive, or secondly is to basically grow it yourself and understand how Mother Nature can convert the elements that are in the air into carbon in the soil. The key thing, of course, is moisture. Nothing will break down or convert without moisture, but regardless of whether you're on high rainfall or low rainfall, everybody has a growing season, otherwise it, obviously the farm wouldn't survive. So the thing is to be aware of when things are going on your farm and then to maximise the growth. And this is where Alan Lauder's carbon grazing comes in, I think, to explain it as well as anybody that I know. And in a nutshell, basically, when a plant grows, if it's 6 inches above the ground, it'll try and establish about 6 inches of root matter below the ground, maintain that balance and be able to get enough nutrients to sustain itself. And then when we graze that plant off, if it's grazed back to 2 inches, then generally speaking, the plant will shed about 4 inches of unnecessary root matter underneath. And this becomes organic matter, which then feeds the microbes. If they're there, the idea of the microbes' job is to access the locked-up nutrients that are in the tiny rock particles that are in all soils, regardless of how sandy or clay they are. But the microbes themselves have to have an environment where they can survive. And like any other animal, they need water and food. The food can be the root exudates, and the moisture has to come out of the, unless you're irrigating, has to come out of the sky. But it's the sort of thing where it's slow to start off, but the more you work on it, the more organic matter gets into the soil, the more the moisture is retained in the soil. So you might start off with very low organic content, and out of an inch of rain, your soil might only retain 10 mils of that, or even less. But as your organic matter builds up, you make more use of the limited rain that you might be getting. So one of the things, I think, is for people to have belief in the system and not give up, so long as they're understanding what they're trying to do, and each year will get a bit easier and easier, having regard that there's fluctuations in the seasons and rainfall as well. So just the thing that I want to stress at this stage, Hugo, is to me, working with microbiology is just another form of animal husbandry, and farmers are quite happy to take on the concept of understanding the animal husbandry around a sheep or a goat or a cow or a horse, but we really need to understand how to manage the microbes in the soil. And this is where people like Dr. Eloning and others, her followers, are very valuable to sort of give a farmer the basics of how to do animal husbandry with these tiny little microbes that we can't even see unless we use a microscope.
Now, David, when it comes to creating this worm composting, when you're doing it on a large scale, how do you sort of set it up in terms of how do you begin, and do you sort of layer it with different materials?
Yeah, look, I think the thing that worries...
I mean, not such a large scale to you, David, sorry, I don't mean the large scale like you're doing for on a commercial operation where you're taking a huge amount of waste, but where you're taking enough waste for your own use, whether you've got 1,000 acres or 4,000 acres sort of thing.
Okay, there's a couple of things. First of all, I think there's a concern amongst a lot of people in relation to whether your compost is aerobic or anaerobic, and there's a general sort of feeling that try to avoid, or some people think you must avoid anaerobic conditions. To me, anaerobic conditions is something that we prefer not to have, but it's not, to me, it's not the end of the world. If I stretch my luck too far and create anaerobic circumstances in my pile, I'm confident that once I open that up to the air or add the worms to it, and the worms by themselves are an aerobic process because they tunnel through it and allow air to get into it, then we can remedy the situation. But generally speaking, the rule of thumb is that if you keep, first of all, in composting, it's generally accepted you need about a cubic metre in density to be able to generate enough heat for to breed enough microbes that are going to break down the material in a rapid fashion. And you've got the choice of either aiming for a process that you can break down matter in the space of 6 weeks, or you can do what I do and say, okay, it doesn't matter if it takes me 12 months. So the difference between one end and the other is the amount of times you turn it over and aerate it. Just as the biodynamic people, they like to just get their heap up, set it up and leave it and just leave Mother Nature to do the job long term. I'm sort of doing that sort of thing again. And once also, the other thing is the amount of moisture that it gets. So your composting, if you don't add water in the drier season, is going to be a much slower process than if it's during the wet season.
Now, when you're talking about when we're talking about worm farming or worm farming or worm composting, you mentioned a cubic meter of stuff heats up. Now, with the worms, you handling them differently to that. So, how do you sort of set it up so that the worms can do the job?
Yeah, that's a good question. You go. When you start to create heat in compost, you can quite quickly get the temperature up to 60-80 degrees, whereas a worm can't tolerate much more than 30 degrees. So you've got to either have an escape mechanism for the worms where they can get to the outer edge or away from the heat. Or what I do is prefer to have two separate operations where I allow the material to compost, and once it's gone past the high heat process, and then bring the worms into it as a second stage. But I often had people at farmers market wanting to buy worms and then telling me that they're going to put it in their plastic composting and even in sometimes into those aerated tumbler type machines. Or there's no way the worms are going to survive if they're doing that rapid aerobic composting with worms locked inside those bins. They were doomed to die. So we used to advise people to do your composting process first, tip the end off out into a heap on the ground, and then put your worms in there, because the science says that whilst compost is renowned for as being a very valuable additive to gardens or pastures, once the worms have done their job on the compost, they're six times the available nutrients for plants. So and as well as that, the worms do bring their own form of antibiotics into the compost. So if you had a system where it's maybe gone anaerobic and some of the nasties or bad bacteria have sort of developed in the worms, will sort of wipe them out pretty quickly.
Now, if a farmer wants to straight away start with worms, like he doesn't want to pre-compost, what's this? How would he set that up?
If you don't want to pre-compost, and you want to, worms will eat fresh food because it's household worm cafes and that type of household worm farms working very well. The important thing, if you're doing that, is to not put more food at the worm's disposal than what they can eat in 1 or 2 days. Otherwise, it will go anaerobic, and even the worms are very reluctant to eat it. So that's why with a little household worm farm, we say to people, just put 1-2 inches at the most of layer of food on top of the worms, and then don't add any more until that's looking more like black casting. And so that's the problem if you just want to use worms. And when McCain approached me, their original idea was they thought that they'd dump the windrows of food waste at the back of the factory in windrows maybe 3 or 4 feet high and just put the worms into it and eat it. I had to explain to them that it's not that simple. That just wouldn't work. And the other thing to remember is that worms will basically eat their own weight in food per day. So if you have a kilogram of worms, you can expect that they'll eat about a kilogram of food. And the rule of thumb in the industry is about 4,000 worms to a kilogram, depending on the size of the worms mine. That I use would probably go about 6,000 to a kilogram. So the thing is, if you're just applying using your food waste to create castings, you really do have to measure the amount that you're feeding. If you're using animal manures like sheep manure, cow manure, horse manure, it's not as important. But the thing to remember there is that compost worms are top feeders, and they tend to stay in the top 3 or 4 inches of the pile. So if you put a pile a metre deep and put the worms into it, even if you covered the worms with a metre of high of manure, within a week you'd find they're all up in the top 4 inches and have basically bypassed the other 32 inches or whatever underneath. So once again, the most effective way is to have an understanding of how many worms you've got, being aware that they'll generally double their number every 2 months, and then add the manure in layers your adding of layers can increase over time as the number of worms increase. Over to you, Hugo.
Okay, so what I'm learning is you just can't. The two processes. One is you have some compost and then you feed that, put the worms in the compost, which is pretty well done or completely done. And the other process is that you give the worms only enough for them to cope with it layer by layer.
Yes. Yeah. It just occurred to me also, Hugo, that one of the ways that we got going, moving from very small to large, is that we just put electric fence around a small area, maybe 30 metres square, and laid out some old hay as bedding, and then would bring the cows in out of the pasture, especially in the spring and autumn when they'd had plenty of good green feed, and then lock them in overnight so they would drop their manure and urine into that straw hay, and then every now and then heat that straw up into a big pile, and it would cook and turn into very valuable compost by turning it 2 or 3 times, maybe once a week, and do that for 2 or 3 weeks. And then once it stopped heating up, put the worms into that. So that's a way that you can make a fairly large volume of worm castings in a fairly short time. And if you're able to put a bit of damaged lucerne hay or pea hay or pea straw into it, you're going to get a really good mix with a lot of good fungi and bacteria in it as well. Over.
Yeah. Look, I'll open up the line for people to have a talk to you, David. So anyone online, just butt in. And I can see there are quite a few people online, so just butt in and ask a question so David can answer your questions. So don't wait, just start talking. In the meantime, so David, you're available to consult with farmers, aren't you?
Yes, I spend a lot of time of evenings talking to farmers. And I also welcome people to come and visit the farm and see firsthand. And I think you'll learn a lot more by actually walking the farm and looking and asking questions as you're observing. But if people are interstate and things like that, I'm happy to talk to people and help them wherever I can.
Right.
The other thing, just on that, just before you go any further, Hugo, in case I forget later, I'm also currently president of the Australian Worm Growers Association. So if people are looking to go down this path, then joining that association and then being able to then access other members in their own part of Australia or have access, you know, better access to other worm growers, because the more people you talk to, the more ideas you pick up. And there are some worm growers who in Australia that are not into their association, but I found generally they're the ones that want to keep things to themselves and are afraid of somebody getting a step ahead of them. But people who join organisations like ours usually have a mindset that the more we learn as a group, the more we all prosper. So being part of the Australian Worm Growers Association is, for the sake of $100 a year, is a pretty good investment, in my opinion. Over.
Right. David, what's a big farm that would use... before we ask about a big farm using vermicompost, the next process is, like your mate up the road, I won't mention his name just yet, but he has had 4,500 acres. He was using your vermicompost and then liquefying it, and he was getting 3.7 hectares of liquid or sprayable material out of one kilo of the vermicompost. I'll just repeat that. So 1 kilo of the vermicompost was giving him 3.7 hectares. Can you sort of have a bit of a chat about the conversion of the vermicompost into a liquid that can be sprayed out?
Yes, well, remember we get, at the start we talked about, it's all about getting organic matter into the soil. If you top dress with vermicast or compost or chicken manure, all those sort of things, you're going to add directly to the amount of organic matter that goes into your soil. But all those processes are fairly expensive, so the much more economical way is to brew up a worm tea. So basically what you're doing is putting the microbes out into the soil that were probably, if your soil's not already in a healthy state, are probably lacking in either number or diversity, then those microbes will stimulate the plant growth that's already there, and then start building your organic matter into the soil via the increased plant growth and the increased activity of the plant shedding their root exudates. But the process is very simple. You can take, I usually, you know, make up 200 litres at a time, and to me that takes about 3 double handfuls, which might be 1 or 2 kilograms. It doesn't have to be precise. The better the quality of the castings you're using, the more diversity you're going to get in your brew. But basically what happens is that the microbes that are in that casting, you dislodge them in to water, must not be chlorinated water, and then you add food in the form of molasses, generally is the most economical way, and then you add a nitrogen source, basically protein or the bodybuilding of the microbes. So we might, for argument's sake, start off with a million microbes in the couple of handfuls of castings that we put in the water. But when you understand that the general rule, the life of a bacteria is about 20 minutes. So, and before they expire their 20 minutes, they tend to divide in half. So after the first 20 minutes, you'll have twice as many to start off with. And if you try and do the sums on that over a 24-hour period, you'll find that the number goes off the page. So what you're actually doing, starting from a very small number, even though a million might sound big to us, you finish up with trillions and trillions of microbes, which can then be diluted down. We're happy to dilute down my 200 litres of worm tea, having been brewed for 24 hours, 5 to 1. Nobody really knows what's the optimum or the minimum you can do, and of course a lot of that depends on what they're going out onto. If you spray it on a bitumen road, you're not going to get much response. But if you spray it on a field that's got moisture in it and at least some organic matter, then you're going to get response. And as you apply your first lot of worm tea, let's just say you have a minimal amount of organic matter in your soil, you will get an increase in growth, which will increase your organic matter. So the next time you put worm tea out, you're going to get a bigger growth, a bigger response, and so on. So what you understand the system, each time you do it, you'll get better and better results. Over, I might have left something out there. I'm wandering a bit. I apologise for that. Here we go.
Okay. Now, is anyone want to ask a question? Just sort of come in online. Okay. Right. David, so if a farmer wants to start on, well, get going on a rather large system, one of the systems was, what I read in the Dave Murphy's book, which is out of print, is you have a windrow and you just move the moisture along the windrow. Is there a better method than that to do vermicompost on a large scale?
Yes, if you get to the stage where you're growing them in windrows, and most people, especially in the summer, your access to water is limited, or at least it's very valuable, and you wouldn't want a windrow, 100 metres long with just a couple of thousand worms spread right through it, because you'd have to water the whole 100 metres regularly to provide the proper environment. So what you would do is you would only water maybe the first 10 metres of the windrow and basically block graze that with your worms, having them all processing that first 10 metres more thoroughly and more intensely. And then once you really see that that's the manure or whatever it is, the material's been 90% converted to worm casting, then you start watering the next 10 metre section, and the worms will quickly move into the, as the first section one dries out, they'll move into the next section. So you can actually, it's not that much difference to block grazing with animals, that you're weeding out one paddock fairly intensively and then moving everything into the next, and you use the moisture as a way of controlling the movement. Over.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing which you explained, that the worms can escape either to the ground or to the side. So can you explain that system, just in case someone builds up something that's too hot for the worms, or in climates like West Australia?
That's right. So if you do, and once again, the best way of avoiding getting too much heat is not having that in any space, a cubic metre of material. So if you just keep it to, less than a foot high, and if you want, you're limiting the distance that you can have your windrows, just make it wider or whatever. So generally speaking, if I'm starting off with a new worm bed, I'll make it just, and I'll spread the manure 4 to 6 inches deep, and then I'll put the worms into that, and then I'll add another 4 to 6 inches, and I try not to go much more than 2 foot or two thirds of them. I apologise for switching from one to the old language, but I'm
you don't layer it. You just have it the 4 to 6 inches one layer. And then when the worms have done a good job, you put another layer on top. Is that how you do it?
Yes, you do. But if you go much more than 2 metres deep, you'll find that the stuff on the bottom tends to start to go anaerobic because of the weight of everything on top and the compaction that causes. So generally speaking, what I do is once I get to about two-thirds of a metre deep, I will, with the front-end loader or manual if I have to, I will remove the top 6 or 8 inches of the pile, which contains the majority of the worms, then I'll take the bottom part out and use as fertiliser or to make my worm tea, and then basically replace the top 4 inches back at the base and start again.
Yeah, so you're working on in layers, preferably with worms.
Yes.
Yeah. And right. So when farmers in sandy conditions, there's the vermicompost tea, because usually farmers haven't got enough vermicompost or any compost to spread on for cropping country. So you'd be using the vermicompost tea. How appropriate is that on sandy, fairly sandy, light country?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a difficult one, and once again, you know, if you're on sandy country, you're generally on low rainfall country, because if you had high rainfall, it wouldn't be sandy. You'd have a lot. You'd be having more regular growth, and the organic matter would be in the soil. So, low rainfall and sandy, sandy country tend to go together. But regardless of that, there obviously still has to be a growth period. Obviously, it is shorter, but once again, it's the same system, but maximising your growth periods, and once again, building up the organic in the soil. And what I would say, I know, you know, some people are talking about 5, 10, 20,000 hectares. The thought of spreading worm tea over that thing is just, it's mind-boggling. But what I suggest to people is that just start off very small, even if you just allocate an acre or 2 acres or even a strip, and experiment following the system on that. And once you're confident that you've got the system right, then you can start expanding, and you might go from just 1 acre to 10 acres, and then maybe do the third year 100 acres or whatever. But it's pretty important that if you're, you know, expending a lot of money on doing it, you're confident that what you're doing is going to work. The other thing that makes it more difficult is that generally, because on sandy country it's not generally cattle country, people have sheep or goats. My experience is the manure from sheep or goats is a much slower process in getting the microbes and the worms to process that. Whereas if you, it's all possible to have cows on it. To me, cows are the quickest possible way of building your more organic matter is for having the cows, as well as doing the block grazing, so you're getting the root exudates. Is having the cows eating the pasture on top, dropping their manure, and then having the compost worms or dung beetles convert that into organic matter rapidly, and then in the wet season you will find that worms will start to appear and take that organic matter down into the soil. So you're basically getting the organic matter into the soil in a way that, you know, you previously might have been thinking about having to direct drill it into the soil or incorporate into the soil when you're ploughing, which we try to avoid. Just bear in mind, I've said this on other tapes, but for people who may not have had them, they did an experiment in the Sahara Desert where they set up a water tank and had a tap on it and just had a dripping. And they went back 3 or 4 months later and found that where they had had the consistent moisture, that there was grass growing out of that small area and that there were worms in there. So Mother Nature has a way that, you know, that there are still grass seeds and worm eggs in any sort of soil from the time, perhaps even prehistoric times, when it was just rainforests or jungles over most of the country that we've since cleared. So the potential is to restore it, but the longer it's been degraded, then the longer it is to restore it. Once again, that depends on how much money you want to throw at it. But to me, it's not unrealistic to do it through the worm tea and proper management. But bearing in mind that you have to also do the holistic grazing management, which is based around on focusing on the amount of time the pasture or the growing material has between times it's grazed. So the longer rest periods, the more effective the system goes. And I know a lot of people in the situation where They're virtually on maximum stocking rates, and it's very difficult. But I use the analogy, if you're driving to a meeting or something and you're running late and you suddenly get a puncture, you've got to decide you can keep driving on the flat tyre or you can be late for the meeting and get out and fix the tyre. So sometimes this repair thing means going backwards before you go forward. Over.
Fair enough. All right, good. With the vermicompost or the vermicompost tea, yes, that can be, for the cropping guys, that can be direct injected as they are planting their seeds, can't it?
Yes, a lot of farmers have successfully inoculated the microbes onto the seed by just having their worm teeth in and a little spray as the grain's going into the auger or somewhere where they have access to it. That has proven to get a much quicker and better strike rate. There has to be moisture there for the plant to do its natural thing, but if there's moisture in the soil and the microbes are there, they will immediately start unlocking nutrients that otherwise the plant didn't have. Because traditionally, for a long time now, we've just thought that you've had to put the super or whatever in there for the plants to access. And there's been this misbelief that because we do soil tests, we test for available nutrients. We think because there's no available nutrients there, well then there's no nutrients. But the vast majority of the nutrients are locked up by Mother Nature to be used in a just-in-time framework, and the microbes are the one that hold the key to doing that.
So, David, the way you described that was I was thinking of direct injecting in as a liquid into the furrow, but you're saying, I think what you're saying is actually wet the grain, sort of use it as a seed dressing.
Well, yes, you can do both. There's nothing, yes, you can, I got sidetracked in my answer there and focused on the inoculating the seed, but yes, you can. It comes back to cost. Just remember that what we're injecting is live animals in the way of microbes. So whether you put them specifically within an inch of the seed or simply broad spray it on the soil, provide there's moisture in the soil, then the microbes are going to be mobile anyway. And it doesn't matter whether you put it an inch from the seed or a foot from the seed, they're still going to get into the soil, start their population increase and still do the same. So it comes back more to the cost of it or what's convenient for whatever equipment you've got, whether you want a direct drill into the furrow or just have a boom spray behind or whatever and just surface spray. But I guess the issue, having thought about it more now, the issue that if you're sowing, if you're sowing on a hot day, then surface spraying, you're going to lose quite a few of the microbes for the ultraviolet light hitting the microbes before they get into the soil. But if you're able, so depending on the weather conditions, I guess if you can spray out in the evening or on cloudy days, then you don't have to do it at the same time as you're putting the seed into the soil, unless then it becomes a matter of economics that you're going over the ground twice. Over.
Usually, or quite often, farms are using at such a large scale, they're many thousands of acres, so seed dressing would be the quickest, easiest, least cost, have the least cost involved.
It would. The seed dressing will give an immediate boost in terms of strike rate But if you can then do a foliar feed once or twice after that, once you've got the leaf there on top of the ground, each time you do that, you'll get an additional boost. So once again, it comes back to economics.
Yeah. Well, all farmers have got some sort of spraying rigs providing a filter of stuff in some format to get through their rigs. They can go out there.
Yes.
Now, we have got the line open, so if you do want to ask David a question, please do. David, Farming Circuits members, he has made himself available to us to talk to, so you've got a double advantage. So is anyone that wants to
Hello, ask you got a question?
Okay, I've got it. It's Roy. Okay, what's your question, Roy?
David, I got a lot of tree material here. I want to compost up on it, but I haven't got much manure or grass to go with. What was your suggestion to break it?
Okay, so you're talking about like wood chip type stuff, Roy?
Yeah.
Okay, so you've got to get your carbon nitrogen right to get it composting. So, the best thing is, first of all, manure. Perhaps if you could access manure from under shearing sheds, something like that might be a source that you hadn't thought of. Or green grass in the growing season, lawn clippings, that type of thing.
Does it have to be grass?
Sorry? So you're breaking up again, anyway. Hugo, if you're hearing the question, you might have to relay it.
No, Roy, just start again. Just try again, Roy. You are breaking up, but try again, Roy.
Yeah, I'm having trouble hearing you. Does it have to be green grass, David, or is it just better be green grass?
No, well, the green grass has a higher nitrogen content, and as it dries out, it goes more to, dry grass, then becomes predominantly carbon-dominated, so... Green grass is far more preferable. You could just try if you had some old hay and mix up a batch of old hay and your wood chips and give it a good old water and just see whether it heats up. You'll soon work out whether there's enough nitrogen in that hay to get the compost process happening.
Oh. And at what stage would you introduce the wood?
Bearing in mind that worms can't survive over 30 degrees, once the heat, it stopped getting above 30 degrees.
All right.
And by the way, having that wood stuff as your base is really good because you can get a really, really good fungal content into your compost.
All right.
Now, just so with that, Roy, I wouldn't. If you've got a large amount, I wouldn't discount the possibility of just spreading your wood chips or your. We're actually using the waste material from Ballarat City Council. It's been through all the green waste, which is basically it's mainly woody, sawdusty type stuff. We're mixing that with the food waste, and that's ideal. But I wouldn't discount the possibility of trialling putting your woody stuff out on the pastures in the autumn and allowing nature to break it down with your... it will be slower, but it's better being out on the pastures than sitting in a big heap doing nothing.
Right. Yeah,
does anyone else want to ask a question? Or, Roy, do you've got another question to ask?
No, I'm wrong.
Just on that, Roy, you know, the line there's pretty crooked. If you want to give me a ring personally some other time, I'm happy to sort of talk more about your current situation, but it's unfortunate the line's pretty static. Yeah.
No, thanks for that, Tucker, David.
No worries.
Well, David, I think we've covered a fair bit of this thing. Is there anything else you'd like to, any sort of messages you'd like to have for the farmers in relation to getting going on worm farming, the value of worm farming? And the one thing that do comes to mind, David, is farmers have been sort of led by vested interests to go down a certain track, and there's a lot of there's a little bit of knowledge to learn in the, when it comes to vermicompost, and it's very inexpensive, and it's something I think every farmer should tackle. So can you, could you like to sort of expand on that, or just say whatever you want to say to wind up to what we're talking about, the value of vermicomposting for farmers?
Yeah, well, I think the reason people are drawn, attracted to farming is because it gives you the opportunity to be the leader of your own, master of your own destiny and be your own boss. So it's a matter of going out there, just learning the basics and then start doing it. And then as you learn and as things go right or go wrong, get involved with other people and share ideas. And the quicker, the more people that you can communicate with, the more you'll learn, and the quicker you'll have success. But it's certainly not rocket science, and most of the experts are really successful when you look at it, people who are staying as close as possible to nature and not interfering with nature's own processes. And it was Charles Darwin that said that the worm was probably the most, I think he put it down as number one invention of Mother Nature. That it was just the most influential animal on the planet. Over.
Yeah, that is saying something, because the worm is such a go-between, the minerals and the nutrients coming from the atmosphere, whether it's carbon or other nutrients that are in the atmosphere. We know there's quite a few there, especially, we just know that there's polyfeeding works on plants, as well as herbicides works on plants. So we know that those sort of things get transferred into the soil.
Yes.
David, I think we'll wrap up this conversation. Is there anything that you would... what's the message that you've got for farmers when it comes to vermicomposting?
Learn as much as you can. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to get on the phone and ask questions, or go and visit other people that are maybe doing it. Even if you think they're not doing it as well as you, you can always learn from watching other people, and just stick at it, but learn as much as you can. I know some people are avid readers, and there are others that don't like reading. Well, I mean, there's an enormous amount of visual material through the Farming Secrets DVDs that have come out over the last few years. Get on YouTube. There's so many different ways you can actually increase your own knowledge. That we're in a situation now with the internet, and even us oldies starting to understand how you can, type in just worms and hear what somebody's doing in America or England or whatever. There's so much more information that we can get out there. So learning about it and understanding what nature meant us to do, it's quite exciting in my opinion. Over.
And a good thing that I remembered, and you might like to verify this, that in David Murphy's book, he says that vermicompost is about six times more valuable than compost. What do you think about that statement?
Yeah, well, that's been proven, and there's a... I can't think of the professor's name in America that's sort of been leading the way. He's got his own department in one of the universities in America. They've done any amount of trials, and so there's a number of different reasons why that is, but they've identified that the worms basically produce or secrete a plant growth hormone, or a number of them, cytokinins, gibberellins, a couple of others I can't remember off the top of my head, but they've identified at least three, and they suspect they're more than they don't even know, but it's basically like it's referred to as a plant growth hormone. They're not sure why it happens, but all the laboratory tests where they've compared the two, you get a superior plant growth around about six times more from worm compost as opposed to normal compost. And not to knock compost, that you basically would probably get the same sort of result if you compared compost to just growing plants in normal soil. But Griffith University is another. There's a guy up there, an Indian professor named Dr. Chan, has also got his own vermiculture department. He's put out a farmer's manual, which is available online, and it also details a lot of the laboratory tests that verify this six times better overall growth. So it's not just something that the worm people are putting out there to try and con people. It's scientifically been verified over.
Well, I think that's a very good note to finish off on, to have farmers appreciate the value of a vermicompost, whether it's worms in the soil or vermicompost, or putting the worms through their compost heap that's been done, because basically that's how the biodynamic system works. It attracts the worms towards the end of their process. David, thank you very, very much for being online. Thank you very much for the farmers for being online. And this will be available as a CD to our farmers. So once again, thank you very much. And I am going to sign off. So, David, do you like to say a parting word?
Yes. Thanks, everyone that's either listening direct or will be listening on the CD. And the more people that become actively involved in sharing what we're all learning, the more we'll all prosper. Thanks, Hugo.
Thank you very much. Wonderful words. Thank you very much, all you folks. Goodbye.
Bye. Bye, Roy.